This is Car Expert.
I've heard the seats are going to be the best carbon seats ever seen on a car.
Tony, I'm sure you've had a look at this car. What do you reckon of the design?
Have they taken up origami in Korea?
There really isn't much that it doesn't do right. It's an absolute home run of a vehicle.
Whoever's got the dash cam tends to hold the evidence. So if you don't have one, it could be a bit of a thing that you debate in court.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. I am joined this week by Paul Marrick.
G'day, Mandy.
And Tony Crawford.
Mandy, how are you?
Hey, Paul. Very good. I've actually had a real good look at that headlight comparison video, Paul, and well done to you and the team for that. It's probably one of the best 16 minutes of automotive content I've seen in a very long time.
So I thought you were about to tell us it was the best 16 minutes of your life, and I thought, well, you're welcome. Yes, for those who aren't aware, we're talking about car headlights, and it is just about to crack 100,000 views, so it is being really well received. We compared halogen to LED to matrix LED to laser. And we went for a drive through the country to see which one looked better. And then we actually put it to the test against a calibrated lux meter as well to see which headlight tech is actually the best. So surprise result as well. So if you haven't seen that yet, hit up our YouTube channel.
Oh, no, what's a lux meter? Is that a lumens meter you mean? Or
Similar. Lux, a lux measurement is the amount of light per area.
Right.
And what the lux meter is effectively like a little globe, and it measures the amount of light that hits that globe. And then it presents it in lux, which is a measurement. So what we did was basically had this lux meter 50 meters away from each car within its light beam. We tested the low beams against halogen, which was on a Kia Seltos. Then we tested LED, which was in a Suzuki Swift. Then matrix LED, which was in a Skoda Superb. And then finally laser headlights, which were on a BMW car. So yeah, it's really impressive light technology. And what surprised us the most was the Swift had incredible headlights, and that is it's a pretty cheap car at the end of the day.
I just wanted to raise on. I was watching Gordon Murray talking about his T50 recently, and he said, and I've never heard this. He said these LEDs run very hot, so they've got like cooling ducts.
Yes,
I've never heard that. I thought LEDs, the reason they became so popular is because they run cold.
No. So they run cool, but the problem is that you're thinking of an LED like a standard light emitting diode, like a flashing light, like a security light in a car. They're very cool and they're very small. The second you try and produce an LED that requires a certain color temperature and requires, in some cases, 11 or 12 watts, that is an incredible amount of energy for an LED. And what they do is they put heat sinks on the back of them. And funny story, that Tesla in the Model S and the Model X, when they deployed those, they didn't dissipate the heat correctly, and they were having full system failures. And because it's all integrated within the cluster, customers were $1,000 to replace a cluster.
So, yeah, I saw the heat sinks on the – they're like lines or ridges.
Yes, they allow air to pass over them, and that
interesting
disperses the heat.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Well, after watching that comparison, Paul, you've motivated me to look at my headlights. I've got a 2012 VW Up.
Yes.
And obviously came out in halogen lights, and I can't legally put LEDs in them. They're not ADR compliant. So I looked into buying better halogen lights.
Yes.
And I've currently got them on order, but they're up to 150% brighter.
Wow.
And I've seen comparisons, and they're obviously never going to be as good as LEDs or further up the chain. But I feel like I see 3 meters ahead of me in the country with that car. Well, it is so dangerous.
That's actually important for you as well, Mandy, because you do a lot of country driving. And what we've found when we did the country tests is just the extra amount of light you see off the side of the road, not so much in front of you. It's where these animals lurk and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's probably the key part. And I'll be keen to see once you do fit them what sort of differences you're seeing. Make sure they're aligned correctly, because whenever you get blinded, it is generally a driver that has installed these aftermarket lights incorrectly and not leveled them right.
Yeah.
It's even got my dad's
It's even got my dad looking at his headlights. They've got a 2018 Serato.
Yes.
Wasn't the top spec. So halogen lights as well. And he's like,
Paul, I remember when my father bought a car in the late 70s, a prestige vehicle from Melbourne, actually, used, but he was boasting about the brilliant halogen lights, and it was actually a Rolls-Royce Silver Shadow. And I don't know what did they have before halogen, dude. I mean, was it a torch? like, was it some form of a torch, like taped into the headlight assembly? Or?
Yeah, I think all you did was taped a lantern to your horse's head.
But no, like seriously, like halogens came out in the sort of mid to late 70s, I think, in very expensive cars. And I was just wondering, what was the technology for the normal car?
You know what it could have been, Tony? Halogen is simply – so turning this into a slight science lesson here, but an incandescent lamp, which is the stuff that we had when we were growing up, it was the stuff you stuck inside your lamps. It got quite hot. It was just a little filament that lit up as a current passed through it. A halogen lamp is similar to that, except it sits in a halogen gas.
Right.
So I think the difference could have been that earlier they were just incandescent globes that would sit inside the car, whereas the halogen was a step up from that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm finding 1962 was when halogen was first introduced.
There you go. I tell you what, I don't think they were introduced, you know, like globally, because I definitely remember him boasting about this car having, you know, halogen headlamps. And that would have been like 75, 76. So I think they took a long time to get here and certainly trickled down to the everyday car.
Gee, they've hung around for a while, haven't they?
Yeah. How are those laser lights from Audi? Did you use an Audi or?
No, we used a BMW. I'm embarrassed to say that my own colleague hasn't even watched it. So can you watch it, Tony, and report back next week?
I might learn a bit.
You will.
Here is this week's car news. And, Paul, it looks like the Triton, the Ranger and the Hilux might have a bit of a rival with the Isuzu D-Max.
Mandy, they're quivering in the corner because the new D-Max, I reckon, looks pretty schmicko. I had the chance to go have a look at the BT50 a little while back and play around with that, and I was pretty impressed with it. And the D-Max kind of builds on that. But brace yourselves, the pricing, holy crap, it's expensive now. So entry level is now a 4x2 single cab chassis. And that kicks off from $32,200 plus on-road costs. And it now caps out at a fairly eye-watering $62,900 for the Crew Cab X Terrain. But there is some good news. As always with Isuzu, they're doing drive-away pricing. So the entry level is $29,990 drive-away, and that top spec is $58,990 drive-away. So in terms of key features, we're talking about a pretty impressive interior with a big 9-inch infotainment screen that has wireless Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. That's like tech that you don't even find on a lot of high-end cars, let alone in dual-cab utes like this. So what do you guys think about the design?
I think it looks pretty good, and it stacks up with the sort of American muscle look that a lot of people are after these days, likes in the Ranger.
Well, truck-like look, I think, is what people are after. And do they have a low-rider?
Tone, can you get a bit closer to the microphone, please?
Is that better?
That's much better. Thank you.
Do they have low rider and high rider, i.e. two-wheel drive / four-wheel drive versions?
Yeah, I think what they're trying to do here is they're rationalizing the range, because I know with the last gen of D-Max, they had so many cars that it was a little hard to keep up with. They're now rationalizing the range, and the reason for that is the whole range now comes with all the safety technology. So even the entry-level SX model has all the safety gear that you know, you get on the top spec, and that means, you know, obviously a bigger price. But the engine is still a carrier. Well, it's sort of a carryover. It's a new version of the engine. So it's a 3-litre, 4-cylinder turbocharged diesel. It now does 140 kilowatts of power and 450 newton metres of torque.
Yeah.
So it is interesting. They've launched it with it not being as punchy as some of the competitors in this segment, like your 500 newton metre outputs from Colorado, Ranger, that kind of thing. So, it's interesting.
I tell you what, bit of a bone to pick with Isuzu back in the day, because I convinced my son-in-law who's a landscaper in Canberra, to purchase a new Isuzu, and he told them that they were going to be towing, obviously, you know, soil and grass and all that kind of stuff, and he wasn't able to actually fit the tow bar to the low rider, the two-wheel drive version that he bought because it basically was too low and it scraped on concrete with even a mild load. So he's hoping that he gets better information from the dealer next time, because he didn't get any joy from the dealer when he complained. He's been living with that same vehicle for about 5 years and it just did a clutch. I don't know if that's normal after 5 years for a ute.
I wouldn't have thought so.
I wouldn't have thought so either. But yeah, anyway, look, I do like the look of it. And if I was buying a ute these days, I'd want that truck-like, you know, that sort of cliff-top look on the front fascia. I think it looks good.
What do you reckon, Mandy, as a female? Does this rev your engine?
Oh, totally. Well, I'm a country girl at heart.
That's
and,
true.
You know, I've never owned a ute in my life.
Really?
But I actually don't mind the look of this, and I really hope it'll give those three top-selling utes a run for their money.
Do you think it's too expensive for as a challenge? Is it a challenger brand? Well, it is in relation to Ranger and Hilux, isn't it?
Look, I don't think it is a challenger brand anymore. No. I think these guys have enough experience now, and obviously, aside from the case you just mentioned there, they have enough reliability as well. But yeah, look, it is getting expensive. I think the biggest price jump was something like 15 grand, which is. That's a big old chunk of money. So, look, the proof will be in the pudding. We'll see with the sales. I think once the hype dies down, if this doesn't have the same sales level as the last one, I guess it'll show that people were only really buying the last one based on price as opposed to it being sort of an all-rounder.
Does Mitsubishi, their top spec, what does that sell for roughly?
Oh, you're putting on the spot here. I think it's the GLX-R Triton. Let's have a look.
45, 50 max?
No, I think it'd be mid. Hold on.
Well, I'm just curious because they have always offered quite a lot of kit for their top spec, and they've always been well under the price of the usual suspects.
It's about 50 grand, Tony, is where it sort of caps out. So it is substantially cheaper than the top spec there of the D-Max.
And does that get autonomous emergency braking as well?
Yeah, that gets all
pretty
all
good,
of that,
isn't it?
Tech. Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. All right. We will move on. And as Paul said in this article, best day at work ever. The BMW M3 Touring is coming to Australia. Wagon fans rejoice. Tony, are you a big wagon fan?
Well, I'm a big wagon fan. I'm a big wagon fan, especially performance versions. And I'm a big a BMW fan. I don't know if you know this, Mandy, but I have raced. An E30 M3 in Portland, Oregon at Portland International Raceway.
Did anyone else know you were racing?
Yes, it was actually a sanctioned race called the Pro 3 Series. And I was invited at another car launch by the instructor. And then I basically flew over on my own bat. I did two races, unfortunately got disqualified in the first practice for overtaking on a yellow. That's never a good idea, I found out. And it was about 180 k's an hour into a corner. Mm. And I thought, oh, I'll get this guy.
I wonder why he's going so slow.
quite bizarre. But look, we had a lot of fun racing BMWs. And believe it or not, I was absolutely flat chat in the last 2 days writing Audi reviews. They seem to be launching more cars than anyone on the planet at the moment. And I got a text from a good mate of ours in Germany, Alex Zilger from Alf Ren, who builds carbon parts for BMW, and he said, "Have you seen the the link to the new BMW M3 wagon?" I said, "No," and of course, I checked on our incredible site, CarExpert.com. And there it was, written by Mr. Scott Colley. Anyway, look, my friend has actually seen the vehicle. And I believe, Paul, you've got a mate that's actually driven it.
Yes. Well, let me just very quickly. So I'm not going to say who the mate is, but I think we both know someone that has seen it. And they both say it looks incredible, even with that big dopey grill. But I think once you put a registration plate in there, it's fine. But more importantly, I've heard that the seats are going to be the best carbon seats ever seen on a car.
Wow. That alone would be enough to get me over the line, to be honest.
Yeah. Like,
Seriously, I, you know, being a surfer and that, and I just wagon suit my lifestyle, and particularly as a daily. And when I'm looking at that massive diffuser on our site with those four pipes that are beautifully integrated, it just looks so cool. Rad, doesn't it? I mean, it just looks amazing.
Please tell me you're planning a comparison with the Audi RS4 Avant.
Well, I don't think it would be fair, Mandy.
Right? I mean, you just have to be.
You know what? I have full utmost respect for Audi products. I just think that when it comes to the performance stuff, it's just not as engaging as something like an M3. And BMW has really gone to town on pushing their cars to the very outer limits in terms of performance.
I won't argue with that, but I do say that you need to drive the latest performance Audis. Of course, the S4 and is coming later in the year.
Yep.
And these, I can tell you with absolute clarity that the new Audis that I've driven in the last few weeks, A4, A5 range, they are a much more refined, far more capable vehicle than the previous iteration of those models. So I wouldn't rule them out, but I think, you know, BMW have been a performance icon, and the M3, of course, is generations old now. They've got a lot of experience building these sort of things, and finally they say yes to a wagon for Australia, which is
normally
just for Europe, right? And we'd miss out. But I think there'll be a big take-up of this vehicle. And I don't know if they're going to – it doesn't say anything about they're going to sort of limit the numbers, but I would suggest that Europe and I wonder if the States would get this vehicle as well, because they'd be big – there'd be big uptake there as well.
Well, that's the thing. The States is funny. They've only just started getting the RS6. So, yeah, it's fascinating that I would be keen to see if they got this. So I think it would do really well in the States. They're big BMW M fans, and certainly I think a wagon would do really well there.
Yeah, given that the new M3, M4, are they not all-wheel drive? Would this be all-wheel drive?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, probably. I don't know.
You would think.
Yeah, as long as it has the selectable rear-wheel drive.
That'd be a bloody close battle then with RS4.
Yeah, that's true.
As long as it comes in a manual as well, right?
Yes, exactly.
All right, another spec has been added to the Hyundai i30 lineup, and it's called the i30 Sedan N-Line, or what it used to be called, the Elantra Sport. It has been announced that it's coming here later in the year, like the outgoing Elantra Sport. This has a turbocharged 1.6-litre four-cylinder engine with 156 kilowatts of power and 265 newton metres of torque. Comes with a six-speed manual and a seven-speed dual-clutch auto transmission. Has wireless Apple CarPlay, Android Auto with a 10.25-inch touchscreen infotainment system. But the exterior styling is the one that everybody's talking about. There's so many angles, so many lines. There's triangular creases down the side of the doors, the restyled front and rear bumpers, and it's got that long taillight stretching from one side to the other at the rear. Tony, I'm sure you've had a look at this car. What do you reckon of the design?
Have they taken up origami in Korea?
It does look like it, doesn't it?
Look, that's a fair bit of grunt there, that power output, isn't it? I mean, that 156.
Yeah, it's okay. It's not going to pull the skin off your face. No, look, I think they're doing really good things at the moment, and I really am not a massive fan of the dual clutch gearboxes they use in some of their city runabout cars and the Tucson and that kind of thing. So I'm curious to see whether this has, you know, an iteration of that wet clutch or some sort of proper variation of a better dual clutch setup, so that it doesn't sort of feel as stop start all the time. It's certainly got the styling now. I'd love to see like a proper N version of this and the Sonata. Mm. I think that'd be cool.
Yeah, I think, Paul, I think that's coming. I think there's going to be a lot of N work done in the next few years. Kicking off, of course, with the new, which you've seen. shot to the new i30. In fact, I think there's a video on the site.
Yeah, we actually just published it today. The next generation, well, next generation in the sense that it's the DCT, the dual clutch, the wet clutch version of the i30, and we spotted that testing in Sydney, and we put a video together comparing the exhaust notes, because our understanding was that the car that we videoed had a petrol particulate filter, and it really didn't sound all that good compared to the manual i30N. So let's hope that we don't let emissions laws and that kind of thing get in the way of the cool note. I mean, that's probably the best thing about the i30N. The sound is so unique and fantastic. I love it.
There's exhaust crackle and pops. You can't go wrong with those.
Yeah, and Mandy, I just wanted to, with Albert Bierman running the entire engineering compound in Korea, I would hesitate to say that the DCT they finally comes to production is going to be quite phenomenal, if not best in class, because I don't think he would risk his own reputation of being someone that delivers something very special, and it will be going through, if it hasn't already, exhaustive testing on tracks at the Ring. You know, they have their own development center at the Ring that they opened, you know, 8-9 years ago. So I'm expecting really, this is going to be something special, I think, that car. And I personally can't wait to get it on track.
Yep, me too. Me too.
And lastly, Paul, the Toyota Land Cruiser Prado is getting some more tech and more power.
Yeah, finally. I mean, this is like the, what's a good example here? This is like the obvious thing that's coming to the Prado, because the engine that's used in the Prado is used in the Hilux, and it's also used in the Hiace. Now the Hilux got a power bump and a torque bump. It's now coming to the Prado, and one would think later on it'll come to the Hiace. It's like the most obvious succession, but Toyota still hasn't confirmed this for some bizarre reason. So basically, we are getting the same engine in the Prado. It's 150 kilowatts of power and 500 newton meters of torque, which is 20 kilowatts and 50 newton meters more than the previous generation of this. It's smartly being fitted with a manual diesel particulate filter burn switch, so hopefully they don't run into the dramas that they had with the Hilux in these. It's getting a new 9-inch infotainment system with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. Pricing is still yet to be confirmed, but look, this has always been a big price premium against other cars in this segment, such as the ute-based SUVs. So I'll be keen to see whether Toyota continues down that path with this.
I love it how they've included paddle shifters in a giant SUV.
Oh, Mandy,
what's the point?
Yeah, exactly. You never know when you face yourself with, you know, if you're driving to the middle of New South Wales and you happen to cross Bathurst, you might come across a race day, and perhaps you need to have full control over your shift patterns. No, I think it's more for towing. It just gives you a little bit more control over it. But at least they're not like the paddle shifters, I think, in the Triton, which are, you know, they measure about 30 centimetres in length and they take up half the dashboard. They're just hilarious.
Is there any idea on when we're going to hear about the upgrades locally?
Look, it'll be in the next month or so. Toyota does this weird thing where instead of telling us when they're going to drop pricing and specs for their new cars, they just at like 5 p.m. on a Friday afternoon go, oh, yeah, here's the new Hilux. And that's what they did last time. And it's like, oh, hold on a second. We need a second here to get all this stuff together. It's your best-selling car. Surely you want to give us a bit of time to get it all organized. So, yeah, it's absolutely bizarre.
Yeah. If you have any thoughts on these news stories we've spoken about, let us know. podcast@carexpert.com.au. We all know just how popular the Toyota RAV4 Hybrid has been, with long waiting lists, but there is another Japanese rival that tends to get overlooked, and that is the Subaru Forester Hybrid. Mike Costello decided to put them head to head in the latest Car Expert comparison. Hello, Mike.
G'day, guys. How are you?
Very well.
How are you, Mike?
I'm sure you would agree hybrid SUVs seem like a no-brainer for families.
They really do. And not only do they seem like a no-brainer, but they're really putting that into effect. Last month, the Toyota RAV4 was the top-selling vehicle in the country, and about 80% of the ones they sold were the hybrid. So, you know, family buyers, even though fuel's probably not quite as expensive as it has been at the moment at other times, family buyers are waking up to the benefits of hybrid, and the RAV4 in particular is taking all before it. Although, as you said, a lot of people don't know that the Subaru Forester also comes in petrol electric form.
Can you give us an idea on the price comparison?
I can, yeah. So here we had the top spec versions of each, because we really wanted to show all the features available. So the Forester Hybrid S, as it's called, is $45,990 before on-road costs, which is $3,000 more expensive in the equivalent non-hybrid version. And the RAV4 Cruiser Hybrid kicks off at $43,290 with front-wheel drive, although you can get all-wheel drive using an electric motor on the back axle for an additional $3,000. And the hybrid premium over the petrol is $2,500. So Toyota's hybrid system is $500 cheaper than the Forester's.
Okay, so I'm going to put in my two cents here. The thing I found really weird, so before I drove the Forester Hybrid, we'd driven the RAV4 and we were sort of big fans of it. Before I drove the Forester, I did some research and found that Toyota owns part of Subaru. So you would think that with that ownership, you'd pass over details about your excellent hybrid system, because I think Toyota's quite honed with their hybrid systems. So when I drove the Forester, I thought, holy crap, this is terrible. Like, it is the worst hybrid I've ever driven. It's quite rough and clumsy. How do you think they got it so wrong, and why didn't they lean on Toyota for a bit of expertise in hybrid drivetrains?
The only answer I can come up with, Paulie, is that this was being developed before Toyota really opened up their hybrid tech. So Toyota's recently become much more open to licensing out its hybrid technology, because the only way to make it cheaper is to make it more popular, economy of scale, et cetera, et cetera. But Subaru must have developed this ahead of time, because as you say, it definitely feels less inspiring. And to give you some idea, the RAV4 pairs a 131 kilowatt petrol engine with an 88 kilowatt drive motor at the front, and you can get a secondary drive motor at the rear if you have all-wheel drive. The Forester's petrol engine has 21 kilowatts less, and its drive motor only has 12 kilowatts. It's 88 versus 12. So it doesn't really do a lot. And the way that manifests is you find that whenever you turn on the RAV4, it starts in silence. It gets off the line as an electric car 95% of the time, unless your batteries are really, really low. You can drive at sort of fixed speeds of 40K or below as a silent EV, so in car parks and things like that. And it's actually really quite punchy and fast as well, because that drive motor is adding a lot into the mix. The Forester, really the only time to actually notice the electric motor doing anything is if you're at very, very low speeds, or if you're regenerating and you want to run ancillaries. You almost don't even notice it's there. And then when you consider that all that hybrid tech actually adds a fair bit of weight, it kind of comes out short. It's slower. It's much less frugal. So the RAV4, 4.7 litres every 100 Ks is the fuel use, and it's 6.7 for the Forester. So the Forester's slower, it's thirstier, and it's much more raucous and noisy as well. As you said, Paulie, it does make a heck of a lot more of a racket. Far less resolved. And it is interesting to me that Subaru hasn't transplanted the Toyota system in.
Have you got any positives at all for the Forester Hybrid, Mike? Nothing towards you, I'm saying, but did you find anything?
Look, to be honest with you, I sort of do fail to see the point of the car. Its fuel use is barely better than the non-hybrid version, and it's $3,000 more expensive. So you can't really justify it. I suppose if I was to stretch, I mean, the Forester itself is a pretty good base to work off. So the inherent strengths of the Forester don't really go away when it comes to the hybrid model. The back seats are excellent, huge side windows, really big glass house. You've obviously got a fair bit of off-road ability. Paulie, you'd remember at the old joint we worked at, we took the RAV4 Hybrid off-road with its electric motor at the rear, and it didn't hold up very well. The Forester's got your tried and true, symmetrical all-wheel drive system, a conventional all-wheel drive system. So if you are somebody who likes to get off the beaten path a little bit, the Forester's going to do it. But again, just buy the non-hybrid one, because it doesn't really save you a whole lot. The only exception is if you're only driving around in town, you're going to get a few more fuel savings then, but really it's very, very limited. This, sometimes when you do a comparison test, it's a bit challenging to work out which is the better system. In this case, it was pretty clear that Toyota's far and away the better system.
Mate, age before beauty.
Can I just ask, Subaru for years, and still today to some extent, they've always had a very, very good build quality and good materials, good plastics. Does it still stack up against the likes of the new RAV4?
I think in some ways it does. Like, it's definitely put together really well. It's pretty bulletproof. all the materials and touch points are nice and soft. It's got, you know, that typical Subaru design of, you know, your drilled alloy pedals. But in that Subaru style, it's also very busy inside. You've got about 20 buttons on the steering wheel. You've got multiple screens. The top screen shows the camera. The bottom screen shows your infotainment. It's a little bit confusing as to how you actually access the information in those screens, and it can kind of give you a sense of information overload. It is a pretty well put together cabin, though. And one of the things I love, and Subarus have done this forever, is visibility. Really thin A-pillars, huge side windows. It's kind of like you're driving a greenhouse. Really, really good in that sense. But then again, the Toyota's interior quality is every bit as good. It's just as practical inside. Its infotainment and its tech is probably a little ahead of the Subarus. It's got a wireless phone charger, for instance.
I tell you what, dude, the styling of that new RAV4, particularly the hybrid that's got extra highlights on it and accents, it's really the duck's nuts, really. I mean,
it looks good, doesn't it?
I really like it's you almost sort of lust after that thing. Like, it's so, you can understand why people are queuing up for it, because there's nothing really to challenge it at the moment. I wouldn't have thought.
That's exactly right.
You know?
And you kind of, if you're buying a family SUV like that, obviously these things aren't designed to go hardcore off-roading, but you are buying into the idea that you want something that's got a bit of a bit of spirit of adventure, I guess, to sort of sound like a marketing type of person. And the RAV4 has that. It looks tough. It's got chunky design. The Forester kind of has a pretty dated look about it. You know, it's obviously in a new generation form, but it's not going to turn heads in the same way that the RAV4 is, which isn't something you would have said about Toyotas 10 years ago.
But I suppose if you've got a weekender and you've got a dirt track or you've got to access your house sometimes down the south coast of Sydney, your fire trails are your only sort of driveway, and you'd probably go with the Subaru.
Maybe, yeah. The other thing I want to flag is cost of ownership. So the other area that Toyota's nailed it is running costs. So the cap price servicing is great. It's $860 for your first four services. The equivalent cost of servicing your Subaru is $2,100. Nearly three times as much. Obviously, if you're buying a hybrid, you're pretty conscious of running costs, right? So not only is the RAV4 better on fuel, but it's actually a heck of a lot cheaper to maintain too.
Hold on, is that $800 for four services?
That's right. So $215 a piece, and the intervals are annual or 15,000 Ks. So dirt cheap to run as well.
So you're almost talking the cost of four services for one service for the Subaru.
Well, in actual fact, the fourth service on the Subaru costs $788. So you're exactly right. There is a reason why this Toyota RAV4 has taken over. It's funny, on Instagram this morning, I saw some figures from overseas, and there are a lot of markets around the world now where the RAV4 is dominating. It's not just Australia. And in Australia, it's so far ahead of its competitors. It's got about 25% market share by itself. And it's a case of, you know, sometimes a car's popular and you sort of think, oh, that's interesting, I wonder why. But when it comes to the RAV4, it actually doesn't do anything wrong. It's comfortable. It's quite sporty. It looks the goods. It's practical. It's well-priced. It's efficient. You know, the Subaru Forester is a perfectly adequate car. Its hybrid system is a bit underwhelming, but, you know, it's not going to offend you in any way. But the RAV4 just, there really isn't much that it doesn't do right. It's an absolute home run of a vehicle. And I really hope that some of the new competitors coming can give it a bit of a challenge. We know that there's a new Nissan X-Trail just around the corner, and I'm really hoping that can shake things up, because as it stands, the RAV4 really has the whole market to itself.
Do you put that down to the styling mostly?
I think in a big way that helps, but It's just so resolved. And again, you know, coming back to the hybrid tech, one area that Toyota's really nailed it is a lot of other brands went away from conventional hybrids. They started doing plug-ins or 48-volt systems or downsized petrols with DCTs, all these different solutions to mitigate CO2. Mm. But Toyota's has been consistently doing hybrid for such a long time that it's absolutely nailed it. Yes, it's not as advanced as an electric vehicle, but it's cheap. You know, it's easy to scale up. It's not going to scare somebody who's a bit sort of technology averse, and it just works as advertised. Mm. It meets the fuel claims that it puts out and just does that job. So I think it sort of nails it in most ways, really.
I tell you what, Mirko, they've got some good colours in that RAV4 too.
Mate, I can see you in one of those top-of-the-range off-road-focused ones. It's got a bit of you about it.
Oh, I like the blue, whatever they call that sort of.
It doesn't have the right brand. You've got to have that Euro brand.
No, mate. I'm the proud owner of two Hyundais.
Of a Porsche.
No, two Hyundai. No. I own a previous generation i30. Diesel Active X, I'll have you know.
Did you accidentally buy that, Tony?
I did buy that from Adelaide, and I'm very very hard to get an Active X diesel engine, by the way. I'm happy to sell it at a profit.
that's not how cars work, my friend.
I own a Kona Highlander, I'll have you know, 1.6.
Handsome looking thing.
Yeah.
So I will just say before we wrap this up that I know it sounds like I've kind of sunk the boot into Subaru a little bit, and I sort of have, but I do have to commend the brand for offering a hybrid version of its Forester. It is only one of two in the class, unless you count the plug-in Outlander, and it's not as good as the RAV4. But you know what? A lot of other brands aren't even exploring alternative powertrains, so at least Subaru's thrown its hat into the ring, and I think it needs to get commendation for that, if nothing else.
Mm. Well, the car expert rating was 7.6 for the Forester and 8.7 for the RAV4, so a clear winner there for the Toyota. That comparison is now up at the site if you'd like to take a look. Mike Costello, thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Going by how many photos we've seen on social media, Tony, you've made it no secret that you're a fan of the McLaren 720S, and I know you're busting to talk about it, so let's give it a, give it a chat about it.
I really am, Mandy.
Can you give us one word to describe that car?
Phenomenal.
don't have to think long.
You don't have to think. And I always like to get some sort of comfort in the reaction from our good mate in LA, Pat Devereaux. And he, like me, and he basically said to me via text that this is the best supercar in the world. And I just looked up my review at the old place from 2019 on an international drive with this thing. And I basically said, not only is it the fastest convertible on the planet, it's also got the fastest retractable hardtop in the segment. I'd also argue it's the most capable and most comfortable. And that's, nothing has changed for me in that car. I genuinely couldn't buy an equivalent Ferrari F8 Tributo against a McLaren, because the McLaren is just, for me, so superior in everything it does, from get up and go. There's no lag in a McLaren. It's the oddest thing. It's a twin turbo, of course, V8, but there's just no lag whatsoever. It's like you're driving a naturally aspirated automobile. I can't explain it. And
Can you run us through the performance specs for anyone that doesn't know?
Yeah, look, it's got 500. So the Spider, the coupe is 509 Australian dollars, 567 for this. So it's a fair bit more. 530 kilowatts and 770 newton meters. This thing will do 0 to 100 in 2.9. I'd suggest it's about 2.8. I don't know if anyone's done some V-box testing in this car, but it is scary quick. But not only, it's the first car I got in the car from CBD in Sydney, and within minutes I felt like, let's go to a track. I mean, this is the sort of confidence it gives the driver, and the feedback that comes back to you. The vision is incredible. It's just honed for the driver.
Did you take it on a track, Tony?
I didn't take it on the track. It's quite hard at the moment to get access to tracks and all that sort of stuff. I've spoken to them about it, and I've spoken to Paul about doing something on that, which I won't reveal on this podcast, but we do want to put that to the test.
Well, Tony, I had the chance to drive the coupe last year, and just like you, I was just blown away with how quick it is. It is just
phenomenal.
You can't even describe it. It's unrelenting. Like it's spectacular. Yeah. My only issue is when you say you'd buy it over a Ferrari. I'm looking at car sales now. $395,000 is the cheapest one. The next one is $400,000. So
yeah, I don't know why, guys, they don't hold their value. I mean, it's a Formula One brand like Ferrari. Everyone that knows anything about supercars and is a capable driver will say they'll take a McLaren all day long. So I don't know what it is. I think they've come out with too many models.
Do you know what I reckon it could be, Tony? You know how when you buy a Ferrari, you get, what, 7-year warranty, 7 years of free servicing?
Amazing.
Perhaps it's something to do with that. I mean, when you look at these cars that are for sale, some of these, this one's a 2017, the cheapest one. Mm. That means the 3-year warranty will be up very shortly. So it looks like they're rushing to get rid of them before the warranty's done. So potentially that's the story, and that's why Ferrari are holding their value better, because it means your warranty's longer and that kind of thing.
Oh, it is, Paul, but Ferrari have quite a unique ownership club, if you like. I mean, it's, you know, you can't buy a V12 until you've owned a V8. There are a lot of these little sort of roadblocks, and they manage the brand very well. Most people refer to Ferrari, you know, as the Rolex of cars, in the way that they're able to increase value for used watches in terms of them. And Ferrari do it very successfully. Not all their cars go up in value, but look, back to the McLaren. I couldn't buy the Ferrari, and I've always wanted the Ferrari. If I bought a Ferrari to be an 812 Superfast or an F12, I certainly wouldn't buy the 8s because of the sound. And the McLaren's no better. It's a bit of a nasty growl. It's a bark, really, in the 720S Spider. But at least you get the faster. It is so quick, that roof. I counted it down to 9.3 seconds. To drop the roof and close the roof up to speeds of about 50 k's an hour.
I've got to just quickly point out there as well, Mandy, are you impressed that Tony can notice the difference between 2.9 and 2.8 seconds to 100 without an actual V-Box, and also the roof counting it down to 9.3 seconds? That's impressive.
I actually did that with my watch. The 2.8, look, I've driven a lot of cars that can do that, claim 0 to 100 in 2.9, and the McLaren, as Paul said, is just so shockingly relentless. And more than that, though, I was recently on track with an F8 Tributo, and there was a bit of lag when I rolled off the throttle into one of the corners at Eastern Creek. I was a bit surprised and spoke to a couple of other journos that had the same thing happen to them, and I don't know. I felt like the McLaren has enormous road holding grip. I don't know if you found that, Paul, but
yeah, absolutely.
It's astonishing speed you can carry through a corner, which again, the Ferrari didn't give me the same confidence. And that was the only thing I could sort of back to back it with, basically.
Which one would you take, the Spider or the Coupe?
Well, if money was no object, I'd probably get the Spider, because, as you know, McLaren's, all of them have a carbon tub, carbon rollover bar for the Spider. So there is actually no difference in performance, 2.9 for the Spider and the Coupe. So why not get the Spider? And because you can just hit a button and that roof goes down in such a short time, why not enjoy it? I certainly did.
We will let you know when that review heads to carexpert.com.au. Dash cams. They're handy for showing someone that amazing supercar you saw on your drive into work, or more importantly, it can be evidence of an incident, especially when you are involved and then insurance companies are involved. Our tech expert, Jeff Quattromani, joins us to talk more in depth about them. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, guys. How are you?
Very well. I'm keen to get your opinion on dash cams first. Do you think they're a good idea?
Look, I think they are, especially if you're the only driver in the car, or the only person in the car, I should say. That's really your eyewitness. It's your second opinion. It's your word against theirs normally. So whoever's got the dash cam tends to hold the evidence. So if you don't have one, it could be a bit of a thing that you debate in court.
Are they actually a legal piece of tech that you can use in court?
You absolutely can submit the video as evidence. If police arrive to the scene, you can replay it instantly back to them, and they can make a decision on the spot if they need to as well. And that's why I think not just having a dash cam is important, but having a good quality dash cam is important too, because, you know, different models don't actually capture everything, and you might find that some models don't capture the speed that you were traveling at the time or the exact GPS location. And then obviously it comes down to video quality too, whether you can really make out what actually happened.
You've sort of touched on it there, Jeff, but how does a dash cam actually differ from just, say, a GoPro or running your phone's camera in a mount, for example? Because there are other camera options out there.
Absolutely. I mean, you can absolutely just get a GoPro. I mean, a lot of motorbike riders do that, where they just strap a GoPro to their helmet to at least record something. And that is better than nothing. But for me, a dash cam means that you're going to have at least recording what's in front of you. Some of them do come with a rear camera as well that you can mount. But also GPS location is extremely important, so you know exactly where you were at the time of the incident. But also the quality of the cameras changed dramatically here too, because the more you do spend on a dash cam, in some ways the better, in terms of, will you actually be able to make out the number plate? If they do almost a hit and run, will you capture that? And obviously managing that speed and tracking that is extremely important too, because if someone says that you were speeding, you can prove that you weren't.
Jeff, I don't have a dash cam in my own car, and my only real experience with them is watching the compilations on YouTube of Aussie dash cams or whatever that site's called, which is normally quite hilarious. But how much would you expect to pay for a good dash cam?
Look, I think if you set aside around the $350 to $400 mark, you'll find a very good dash cam, and not just one that's going to look good during the day, but one that actually captures really good night vision as well. And I think what I've found in testing and what we post on Car Expert as well is that during the day, most cameras look pretty good. But once it comes to the evening, will you be able to make out that there was somebody on the side of the road about to cross in front of you? That's the type of stuff that you need captured at nighttime, and some dash cams just do not hold up to muster.
Have you found any portable units that are worth looking into, Jeff?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think tossing up between Uniden and Navman seems to be the two of the best at the moment that we've tested. I've tested cheaper brands such as Navigator. You know, they're the types that you'll find at Big W and others. They're okay if it's a once in a while sort of road trip. But if you're going to be doing something like maybe you're an Uber Eats driver or you're a driver taxi, that's when you want something that's properly mounted in the car and going to sit there forever.
Do, around that price point, do most of them come with a front and a rear-facing camera? Because my fear would always be with one of the basic ones, and in a past life at Harvey Norman, I actually used to sell them, that you'd have it pointing out the front of the car doing the right thing and then be whacked up the rear in the middle of the night while the car's parked on the side of the road and get nothing out of it.
That's really important to note. So about 30% of accidents actually happen from the rear. So if you do spend around that $400 mark, they all should come with that rear camera. It does mean you need to run a wire essentially from that front camera all the way to the back one to make sure it's connected. And you mentioned a really good point there around parking, because so many accidents happen when you're not even in the car. You're just sitting there and someone's reversed into you as they were trying to park and they've then done the runner. Most of those cameras at that price point will automatically turn on and capture them at least driving away, because it feels the bump. And that's one of the great things that you want in a dash cam, is something that's really looking after you when you're not even there.
Well, this sort of leads us into the next segment here, Jeff. We've seen some manufacturers introduce built-in cameras, but not necessarily on the dash or on the rear of the car. And obviously, the more famous one is being on Tesla. What do you think of these sort of cameras?
Look, I love the fact that they have it. I mean, for most of these cars, the cameras are there already, whether it's a reverse camera or cameras that are really mounted for 360-degree footage at the moment. All that they're really now doing is allowing you to record. Now, the last time I drove a Tesla, it was a Model X, and I did use the dash cam footage. And to be honest, the footage was quite poor. It was nowhere near comparable to these $400 models that we're talking about, but it's something. And it's something that you don't have to worry about mounting. It's always recording. And I think you had to put a USB stick in the center console to make it work at the time. But you can see so many people, especially Tesla drivers, where we're seeing that they're parked somewhere and for some reason people have a grudge against Teslas and they're just keying the side of them, and they're actually being caught out with those cameras that are on the side of the car. So I think it's an amazing feature to add.
Jeff, you quickly touched on the fact that in a Tesla, for example, you need to plug in a USB stick to record the vision from the body-mounted cameras. Mm-hmm. In some of these ones that you're talking about that you buy from the store, how often would you need to be swapping memory, like an SD card or any sort of storage system?
Yeah, it's a good question. And for most of them, I put a micro SD card in, usually around 32 gig. For me, the reason is that the footage will actually overwrite itself. Once the card is full, it starts to then overwrite from the oldest video that you've got stored. And I think that's okay, so you don't have to spend too much money on the card itself, because in reality, if something happens, you're going to want to capture that footage straight away and take it off the card immediately. I doubt that you'd wait, a week, for example, before looking at that footage. The important thing to note here too is that most of these dash cams have Wi-Fi and have apps associated with it on your smartphone. So if something does happen, you don't even have to take the card out of the camera. Just pull your smartphone out. That data will transfer across, and then you can either share it or do whatever you like with it, basically.
So, Jeff, are there any issues of legality running a dash cam? Because presumably you can't just film people without them knowing in a lot of places in the real world. Are you allowed to just run a dash cam in all states in Australia?
Look, to my knowledge, you can. And the reason I say that is because you're on a public road and, you know, we're not really recording anything that's particularly private. These are things that people can see publicly. If you're driving somewhere and I do film what you've done on the road, I'd be very surprised if anyone raised a privacy concern around that. We have speed cameras that capture images of what's happening. We even have motorway cameras as well. So I'd be very surprised if anyone raised an eyelid or, you know, batted an eyelid at that sort of thought.
You can search dash cams at carexpert.com.au to read on Jeff's full detailed report there. It's very interesting. Jeff Quattromani, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That brings an end to this week's podcast. Yeah. Tony, you're out of a McLaren and you're stepping into a bizarre vehicle next week.
Mandy, I'll have to look it up what it is, but it's a Peugeot Expert. Fitting for our website, I might add.
The irony here is perfect. The expert needs to look up what an expert is.
Exactly. I've been told it's a van.
Correct.
I'm assuming it's not a performance variant.
I have this visualization of Tony behind the wheel of a van, and I find it hilarious. I don't know why.
I know. It's a little bit depressing. Apparently, I was supposed to pick it up today, so I've got to pick it up on Monday.
You'll love it, Tony. It's actually not a bad van. The Expert's pretty good, so it's a good alternative to something like a Caddy. It's sort of that size segment.
I have fond memories of the Renault Kangoo.
Oh yes,
diesel manual. Now that was a great little thing. I really enjoyed that car. Well, it drove like a car.
Yes.
I was impressed with it.
Yep. Same with the Caddy. They're very car-like in terms of the way they drive those small events.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll be interested to drive this. When would you like me to write it? Between Audi reviews or?
Well, unfortunately, you've been a bit tied up with Audi reviews. I really do hope that you can get through literally the entire range before the end of the month.
It's quite bizarre. Is Audi the only people launching new cars at the moment?
You know what? To just delve into politics and the pandemic situation very quickly, I think they've seen the writing on the wall with what's happening in New South Wales, getting cases and all this sort of stuff. And I think they're trying to rush through every single car launch for the
Pretty
next
much.
2 years in the next 4 weeks.
Yeah, I commend them for, getting off their backside and making stuff happen, I suppose. But
at least
they're
doing something.
Yeah, exactly.
We're up to episode 6 of the Car Expert podcast, Paul, and we've had some wonderful support over these 6 or 7 weeks.
Oh, yeah, just a massive, massive thank you to everyone that listens and has left us a rating. If you haven't had a chance to do that yet, whichever podcast platform you listen on, please feel free to leave us a rating and let everyone know what you think of it. Feel free to share the podcast as well with your friends. And keep in mind as well that we have another podcast that we run parallel with this, which is, I guess, the Founders podcast. It's uncensored, so please don't listen to it if you are offended by Tony slipping out the occasional F-word.
Our last one is actually going live.
Well, it'll go live very soon, Tony, and that's on the cars that we bought. So I think people will find that one interesting. But, look, we really appreciate the support. So thank you so much for tuning in. And also with the website, we ran through an update for all the PR people in the industry on how we're doing. Last month, we cracked 840,000 unique visitors. That is incredible for a site that's been running for, 2 or 3 months now during a global pandemic. So, we really just appreciate all the support from everybody and everyone just really sort of getting into it and joining us on the journey.
And you've had some big numbers with YouTube subscribers too, haven't you?
That's it. We actually just cracked 30,000 subscribers too.
That's
which
amazing.
Yeah, which is, I don't know. We
commendable.
We've put a lot of effort into it, but we really appreciate the support there too. If you haven't seen the channel yet, just head over to YouTube.
I wonder if we'd be at 40 if I started doing video.
Probably not, Tramp.
Hey, I'd watch a video review of a Peugeot Expert with Tony on the camera.
So
any day.
Would I.
Yeah. can I just say COVID hasn't been kind to my waistline, and I don't want to do any videos at the moment. I'm desperately trying to shed some weight.
Well, I'd love to know how you actually rolled into that McLaren. I'm genuinely interested.
Well, it's a good thing it's a spider because you can grab the window frame and pull yourself out.
Paul Marrick and Tony Crawford, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mandy. Thanks, Paul.